Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and with me is the woman who's been known to jump in a fountain or two. It's Lydia.
I always wanted to enact that scene from that movie. Not this movie. But, you know, they talk about it in so many other movies. And, yeah, and I've never gotten to climb around in a fountain. I feel like I'm really missing out on something in my life.
You know, I can't say I've ever really felt the need to. I usually go to the fountain and see all the bird crap all over it and figure that's in the water too. So I...
Well, you're not supposed to drink it unless you're in Paris. Apparently Paris has an amazing free public water thing where you can just go around to water fountains and it's like really good water. And speaking of Paris, so maybe we're in the right movie for that.
Maybe. I don't know. But doesn't stop the pigeons from...
That's true. But you know, there's something romantic and wistful about, I don't know, I was gonna say something
that could
get us banned. I was gonna say getting wet in public, but now that sounds horrible. And hey, the swimming pools are open. Yay! Happy summer, everybody.
Well, before we go any further down this road, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphaned Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcast and wherever you choose to listen, if you have the option to do so. Please rate and review the show. That helps get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully into more ears. Another great way to help is just by sharing the episode you're listening to on whatever social media platforms you use. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we have covered here on the show. And if you would like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. Let's listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we will parlez-vous en français as we talk about the last time I saw Paris.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Crossword Puzzle Murder. When a Dr. Ingalls was found dead in his study, a crossword puzzle unfinished in front of him, police called me in, knowing I was an avid crossword puzzle fan. A prime suspect was the doctor's son, Arnold. I noticed the number 7 down was circled. I checked the puzzle, and the number called for the two-letter word for a three-toed sloth. Ingalls had identified his murderer before he died. It was young Arnold Ingalls, the doctor's son. In a moment, I'll tell you why.
Just how drunk are we gonna get?
Welcome to Good Beer, Bad Movie Night, where each month we drink finely crafted brews while watching terrible films in order to see just how drunk you have to get to enjoy them. So tune in and join Troy.
Kilmoy Kreitz.
Oh, that was pretty good.
Thank you.
Dave.
I have the weirdest boner.
And Pete. IPAs are ales, meaning they are bottom fermented. Excuse me, they are top fermented. I f*** that up. Try that again. As we drag Kathleen.
Hear me.
Kicking and screaming through an alcohol-fueled podcast dedicated to movies of questionable quality and the frosty adult beverages that help make them tolerable. Good beer, bad movie night. Clearly, it's the beer's fault.
In the case of the crossword puzzle murder, the two-letter word for a sloth is spelled A-I. A-I also happens to be the initials of Arnold Ingalls. Thus, a puzzle unpuzzled a puzzle. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
The Last Time I Saw Paris is a film from Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. It's loosely based on F. Scott Fitzgerald's Babylon Revisited. It was directed by Richard Brooks and stars Elizabeth Taylor, Van Johnson, Walter Pigeon, with Donna Reed and Ava Gabor also appearing, along with George Dolenz, father of Mickey Dolenz of Monkees fame, and in his American film debut, Roger Moore. This film was released in 1954. However, an error in the Roman numerals displayed in the film's copyright notice showed 1944. Under the then active copyright laws, the film's copyright began 10 years prior and subsequently ended after the 28-year copyright term in 1972. MGM failed to renew it either through neglect or ignorance, thus allowing the film to fall into the public domain. We will call this one truly an orphaned film.
It really is.
In the film, former Stars and Stripes reporter Charlie Wills returns to Paris after several years being away in order to visit his young daughter. There, he visits some of his old haunts, including the Café Dingo, where he begins to remember times from years before, right after the war in Europe ended. In flashback, we find Charles amongst the celebrants, where a woman embraces him and kisses him before she runs off, and he is pulled in the other direction. Finding his way to the Café Dingo, he bumps into a friend, Claude, who is sitting at a table with another woman. She introduces herself as Marion and invites Claude and Charles to her father's house to join the party. At the house, Charles discovers that the woman who kissed him earlier is none other than Marion's sister, Helen. The two begin a romance and eventually marry, much to Marion's annoyance. We follow the two through their lives as they struggle to make ends meet, living a life of wealth and endless parties despite having almost no money, until the family joke, a bunch of Texas oil leases, actually hits oil, providing the family with the wealth they had previously only pretended to have. Seduced by decadence and depressed after repeated rejection letters from the novels he's trying to write, Charles' alcoholism begins to drive a wedge between the two lovers. That wedge grows when both Charles and Helen find themselves the objects of affection from young, beautiful suitors. When tragedy strikes the family and Marion takes his and Helen's daughter away from him, a despondent Charles finally retreats back to the States. And where do I even begin with the cast on this one? There is no way I can do these stars justice, so bear with me as I give the briefest of background info on a couple. Elizabeth Taylor was British-born to American parents. Her mother, a former stage actress, groomed her for stardom after the young four-year-old performed and was applauded for a solo routine at a dance recital. The family moved to Los Angeles in 1939 when Taylor was just 7 years old. In 1941, her mother, using connections with friends working there, managed to get Elizabeth under a contract at Universal Pictures, and the girl made her film debut in a short film, There's One Born Every Minute, co-starring Carl Alfalfa Switzer of Argang fame. Universal studio execs weren't as impressed with the starlet, saying her eyes were too old and that she did not have the face of a kid. Dismissed by Universal, her father's friendship with MGM producer Samuel Marks allowed her to get signed on with that studio. She filled a needed part in the 1943 film Lassie Come Home as Priscilla, a granddaughter of a rich Yorkshire landowner. Still not finding many fans of the studio, she was loaned out to 20th Century Fox for a small role in their 1944 adaptation of Jane Eyre. Now 12 years old and slowly breaking away from her mother's micromanaging of her career, Elizabeth set about to secure the part of Velvet Brown, the heroine of National Velvet. She did everything she could to charm the head of the talent department of MGM, Lucille Carroll. Her efforts paid off and she won the role. The success of National Velvet secured Taylor as a bankable movie star. She managed to avoid a teen's awkward stage and immediately blossomed into a beautiful ingenue, believably playing a teenager or an adult with ease. Over the next decade, Taylor had to convince studios and critics that she was more than just a pretty face and took on several dramatic roles. 1951's A Place in the Sun erased any doubts and should have given her some choice parts, but her following films were received as no more than average, including the film we'll be discussing today. She was, however, making plenty of press due to her marriages. First, briefly to hotel magnate Conrad Nicky Hilton, and then within a year of her divorce to British actor Michael Wilding. She would garner critical acclaim for her role in the 1956 film Giant, co-starring Rock Hudson, whom she would have a lifelong friendship with, and James Dean. Over the course of her multi-decade career, she would garner 5 Academy Award nominations, 6 more marriages to 5 more husbands, she famously married Richard Burton twice, and became an outspoken champion for AIDS research, as well as a tabloid fixture as a best friend to pop star Michael Jackson. Now, I have skipped so much in order to make this not a 2-hour episode or anything, so please look into her amazing career herself. Even beyond her filmography, I think she's just a She is a life to kind of study, I think.
Yeah, she's an interesting, really interesting person. I think she's interesting to watch. Like, I've always had it in my head that she's just this phenomenally glamorous person on a level with Marilyn Monroe. You know, there aren't a whole lot of actresses out there who are better known. And, but watching her she's just fascinating to watch. She's so interesting. I'm going to struggle so much to try and explain how I feel about her. but even and maybe especially in her older roles in like the late 80s and 90s, she suits them. Like she seems so glamorous. It's just really fascinating to watch her, I think. I think it would be impossible to do her justice in the matter of a few sentences just for the sake of her, like, I hate to use the word notoriety, but notoriety is the right word. Mm-hmm. So it's so much fun to get to cover something with Elizabeth Taylor in it, because that's one of those names you think, oh, well, we'll never get to cover anything with Elizabeth Taylor. We'll never get to cover anything with Marilyn Monroe, you know. Oh, we never get to cover anything with, you know, Rock Hudson, those big names. So it's such a treat to get to do that here.
Yeah, absolutely. Very quickly, a little bit about Van Johnson. He was originally a Broadway dancer before finding his way to Hollywood. He was well-liked by studio for his boy-next-door freckled face and boyish charm. He appeared in a number of films for Warner Brothers and MGM, and his breakthrough performance was his rookie bomber pilot in A Guy Named Joe in 1943, which starred Spencer Tracy and Irene Dunne. In the film, Johnson's character acquires a deceased fighter pilot as a guardian angel. Midway through the production of the film, Johnson was involved in a serious car accident that left him with a steel plate in his forehead and scars that the plastic surgeons at the time were unable to completely erase. MGM wanted to replace him for the film, but star Spencer Tracy convinced them to pause production until Johnson had recovered. The film was an enormous hit and launched Van Johnson's career.
I want to jump in there real quick and say we saw Van Johnson in something else already.
Did we? What was it?
He did in Go for Broke, the movie that we loved about the Japanese unit in World War II.
That's
he was
right.
The token white guy. And so when I saw his name, I was like, why do I love Van Johnson? What was it that I saw? And as soon as I found that, I was so excited. So I want to encourage everybody listening, if you haven't listened to our Go for Broke episode, go find it. Go watch that movie. It's 100% worth it. It's one of the few that we both agreed was just 5 stars or 5 Othels worth. Absolutely worth a watch and worth a listen.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for reminding me, because I don't know how I missed that.
I didn't know how I saw it, but yeah, I'm really happy I did. I think I remembered his name.
So I could continue on about Walter Pigeon, a personal favorite of mine, or Ava Gabor, or Donna Reed, or George Dolenz, or Roger Moore, or even about director Richard Brooks. But again, we only have so much time, and we likely have a lot to talk about. So I'll just leave it at that. This was a first-time watch for me. It's a film that I knew about. I'd heard about it, probably because of the cast, if for no other reason.
Yeah.
But no, it's not one that I had ever seen before. So it was a joy to finally sit down and watch this one. And like you were saying before, an opportunity to watch a film with Elizabeth Taylor and Walter Pigeon and Roger Moore, all these people that, I mean, we are so lucky that someone made a mistake and then the studio compounded the mistake and we get an opportunity to watch and discuss this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Being also a big Technicolor, we rarely get to see something in this nice of color film. We've seen some early Technicolor.
Yeah.
But it was kind of nice to see one sort of, once they figured out how to do it.
yeah. It's, I think it's the filmography on this is really smooth. It's pretty. And it actually, the version that we have up, the version that Orphaned Entertainment has up on YouTube, is very clean. And it actually looks, I think, sharper than I had expected it to, especially the early shots of Van Johnson. First of all, like, you can see his face really clearly.
Yeah.
I had pulled up another version of it through another streaming service, and the audio was extremely muffled on this other version. It's very nice and clean on ours. On ours, on the one that we have put up. It's not ours. We don't own it.
Nope.
but I was surprised by how good it looked. I think for some reason I expected it to be a little bit more grainy, a little more fuzzy, almost like it almost to me looked like it had been remastered.
I'm not sure. I mean, I pulled ours just from another online source.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of clicked through. I looked to try to find a good, clean copy. And most of the ones I were finding online seemed pretty clean and seemed pretty nice. So it was just like, oh, well, I guess this one will do. And that's the one I grabbed. So if it's something that shouldn't really be up there, I apologize.
No, but I don't necessarily. I'm not saying I think we messed up. I'm saying I'm impressed by the quality of this film. I think it looks really nice. I think there are some big crowd scenes in it that I would have expected to feel like they were B-roll, and they actually they look really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's nice to watch a movie. This movie is from 1954, so it's not super old. It's, you know, it's toward the newer end of some of the stuff we've watched, but it's nice to see something that's like nice and clean and you're not squinting it. I love black and white, but it's nice occasionally to see something that you don't have to struggle real hard to see what's going on and to hear the audio on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Aiding to the fact that this film looking nice, they actually did indeed film on location in Paris, and then of course did studio, and I think in a few occasions did just some rear projection.
Yes, yeah.
On a couple occasions. But even the rear projection, I thought they did a pretty nice job kind of matching it up with where we just physically were a few minutes ago in the film.
Yeah.
It did a pretty nice job.
Most of it doesn't jump out as being incredibly rough. So, I mean, as films we've reviewed go, the quality looks really nice. The audio sounds really good. Of course, the lead actors are beautiful people. It's not hard to do when you're talking about Van Johnson, Elizabeth Taylor, Roger Moore, and Ava Gabor, all these beautiful, beautiful people. Donna Reed with dark hair, that's a lot of fun. If you guys are like me, you always think of Donna Reed as the Donna Reed Show. And so seeing her come on and have dark hair was a lot of fun. I was like, oh, what happened? And then immediately my brain goes to, was she naturally blonde or was she naturally brunette? It doesn't matter, but I'm curious.
I found it real interesting looking at Van Johnson in color. Gopher Brook, if I'm not mistaken, was black and white, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yes. So seeing him in color, he's got the appearance that I'm not completely sure he could be a star today with all the freckles. And then we read about the accident. So you could see the scars in his forehead, you know, and then like this, they were saying the freckled face and the red hair and everything. It's like, you know, I don't know if you could sell that today.
He still has that classic jaw. He still has that straight nose, the boyish good looks and all of that. I think he, with the scarring, I think you're right. I think he'd have struggled a bit more. But I also think he's very, in this movie, he's quite a bit older than he was in Gopher Broke. And so you can tell he's aged.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in his younger years, he wouldn't have had any trouble at all. I think he would have done Zac Efron proud. Would have given him a run for his money.
They might have cast him in some action films. I could see him
Craig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a good point. Elizabeth Taylor, as you said, has quite a bit of notoriety. I think I know her more for her notoriety than I do a lot of her films. I've seen a few of her films. I believe I watched Giant once decades ago. I've seen her in some films that probably towards the end of her career, like you were mentioning before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I probably have not seen as much of her as as someone who hosts a podcast about old films, mm-hmm. I have not seen her as much as you might think.
I got kind of interested in her. You mentioned her being in Giant, which starred Rock Hudson and James Dean. And I got a little bit interested in that. There's a Netflix miniseries called Hollywood that partly follows the life of Rock Hudson. And he and Elizabeth Taylor, of course, starred in that, became very good friends. It's a very interesting series. It's worth mentioning that it is not strictly historically accurate. It's touted as being a kind of what if Hollywood were more open, if Rock Hudson could have been more, you know, out and all of that kind of thing. But it made me really curious. So we ended up watching a biography about Rock Hudson, and she was interviewed in it. And she became really passionate about supporting him because of his struggles with AIDS and all of that. And I think what you're saying is exactly right. I think most people know her more from being a personality, mm-hmm. from being, you know, from having the glamorous life, the perfume line.
Yes.
I knew her primarily from National Velvet because you guys may not know this, but I was a massive horse nerd when I was a kid. I loved horses. And so National Velvet was in like my top five films, and I watched it I don't know how many times. It just is really interesting. She was in so many different movies that really I think were big names, you know, but it is true. She's such a unique look, and she always has this kind of airiness to her, the way she speaks and the way she looks. She's kind of ethereal.
Thank you. That's a very good word, because I was thinking, you know, she sort of just glows when she's on the screen.
I wouldn't use that term for almost anybody, but she always is kind of just a little unusual, not in a bad way at all. I realized just a minute ago that the director actually also directed Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, mm-hmm. which is... man, a powerhouse of a movie for sure. A heck of a role, a heck of a cast, just like this one, like a phenomenal cast, same director, different storyline, of course. But she always kind of, I think, feels too good for everybody else. Like she's too good for all the people around her. And I don't know how to explain it. And I think I equate it with Marilyn Monroe, because Marilyn Monroe kind of has a similar thing going. She kind of floats above. Like she's interacting with the other characters, with the other people that are there, but she never feels like she really belongs in the setting. And I think she really gives that impression in this movie. And they definitely play up that character that way, where she says, don't let the party ever end. Promise me, you know, it'll always be fun and champagne and bubbles, and we'll just always keep the party going. But there's a quality to Elizabeth Taylor herself that is very much along that line, too. Mm-hmm. Not that she's necessarily flighty. She just sort of is a little bit apart. So it's interesting to see how they used that in this film. I can see how it would have given her a lot of trouble with traditional roles, because when you get these roles where, great example, like The Quiet Man, where John Wayne grabs Maureen O'Hara and kisses her real passionately, it kind of feels like you can't do that to Elizabeth Taylor. It's almost like she's like water. She just slipped through, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't know how to explain it. I'm getting all poetic. I don't mean to be. It's the cold medicine. No, but she is very, she has a very unique presence.
Yes. And I think she is the very unique appearance too. I was sitting here thinking, yes. she's glamorous, but she isn't necessarily just 100% glamour. There's a little bit of the girl next door quality about her as well. I think she sort of walks the line in between somehow, where you could see her, someone like her, you could see her living down the street from you. Or you could see her up on the billboard, you know, selling the latest and greatest makeup or fashion.
She almost looks too perfect. And it's interesting to me that you said that studios didn't care for her appearance because they thought her eyes looked too old. Because mm-hmm. in this movie, I feel like she always has this kind of childlike quality to her. It's so interesting that I think that's what they say, you know, hey, I'm going to use a French term here. The je ne sais quoi. There's just something about her you can't quite put your finger on. And in that sense, the main characters in this, even though it's clear she's crazy in love with this guy, there's always a little bit of a problem because I feel the whole time like he's not quite good enough for her. So it's an interesting dynamic in this movie.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think that as the term goes, he's punching up.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And it's funny because at the very beginning of the movie, you know, and she's saying, oh, you know, let's promise me you'll never let the party end. And I'm thinking, oh, man, this girl's a floozy. But then pretty quickly it kind of goes the other way. And he becomes, you know, he becomes F. Scott Fitzfrickin' Gerald. He becomes the obsessive writer that's, you know, moody and unhappy with the results. And I seriously had to look at this and wonder, is this largely autobiographical? Did Fitzgerald write this? I mean, he certainly wrote for some news agencies, for some, you know, regular publications, things like that, to kind of keep money coming in. And I'm sure he experienced his fair share of rejections. And I wonder how much of this movie is from that. And it feels like, it was interesting. It feels like you're supposed to feel a lot of sympathy for Van Johnson's character, and I think you do at the beginning, but that started to taper off for me. And maybe that's the alcoholism, but maybe it's just that the character's kind of problematic.
I found it interesting, and knowing that you're a writer yourself.
I was not bringing that up. No, but it's great that you did. I just didn't want to be the one to.
He writes a novel, he sends it off, it's rejected. So apparently he just sets that novel aside and starts another one.
I'm like, yeah,
is there only one publisher in Paris that he can send this
Scrivener.
Thing to?
Scrivener is the only publisher in the world. No, of course not. Doubleday also exists. Penguin House, Random House too. No.
I found that really odd that he just like, well, this novel didn't sell to this publisher, so.
Yeah, it was incredibly odd. It was incredibly strange. And there's an amount probably of compression going on because we're in a movie, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I looked at my husband and I said, if I reacted the way he just reacted every time I got a novel rejection, would you still be married to me? Because he throws an absolute screaming tantrum. Like he just like loses his mind that he got one rejection. And again, maybe there's compression that we're, you know, we're not aware of going on during this story. Many, like the vast majority of books are rejected 50 times, 100 times.
Yeah, and I don't think you just put that aside and start another novel in hopes that one will sell. Like,
no.
Why don't you keep trying to sell that first one there, buddy?
Yeah, keep sending it out over and over. And I imagine this has to do with compression, right? I think this is, they're trying to fit it into a single movie. They could have done it, though, very easily with, you know, the overlay of rejection letters or whatever. But yes. It is a little bit weird. It is a little strange the way that they present it. And he definitely does not react like, I think, a human. Now, on the other hand, story goes that Stephen King threw Carrie away. It was in the trash and his wife fished it out. So, not, I know, right? So, it's not that he couldn't have written a good book and then set it aside. It's more his response to not getting somebody to publish his book. I think his reaction to his coworker getting a contract for a serial for $15,000, I think is much more real. Mm-hmm. I think for me, you know, when I hear, you know, oh, somebody found an agent for their book, I go, oh, I like, Oh, why not me, you know?
Yes.
Why not me? Isn't there a song? Yeah, I just break into that song. And I would expect that for this guy, but he's a newspaper reporter. He would have had rejections on stories. He would have had things not get printed before. And so for him to write one novel and then have that dramatic of a reaction to it, and then she just keeps supporting him and loving him and bolstering him, and then she starts spending time with a single younger man, and I'm like, wait, what just happened? What just happened? She's been like supporting this guy, and you don't see a moment of her becoming despondent, feeling ignored. It's just all of a sudden there's this tennis dude and she's hanging out with him too. And maybe this is a European thing, because I've seen this in more than one movie around this era. Maybe this was a thing back then where it was more kind of accepted for married women to spend time with single younger men in public, in company, right? They're not, presumably they're not going and hanging out at his apartment by themselves all the time, but it definitely felt like a hard right in the story for her to suddenly, still obviously adoring her husband, be spending all this time with another man.
Yeah, I think that is kind of something this film suffers, I think, for just about all the characters, is there is a lot of sudden right turns, mm-hmm. you know, for everybody. For a film that's nearly 2 hours long, there is a lot of, and suddenly,
yeah,
and like, oh, okay. I noticed that not just with her character, but I think with Charles Wills as well, Van Johnson's character, Donna Reed, her character just sort of just comes in and out of the frame occasionally throughout the film, and she kind of shows up to like throw daggers with her eyes and then she leaves for a good 45 minutes.
This is an adaptation, and so I wonder how much of her story is kind of lost in mm-hmm. the translation or lost in the switch from book to film. And whether she existed at all in the book in the first place, right? This is, again, we're running into this where, oh, it's a movie based on a book. And so, darn it, we didn't read the book. Maybe somebody can tell us. But it's, I felt like her character, she and the father are the most consistent people in this movie. Mm-hmm. Because she, the whole time, obviously, she really likes Van Johnson's character. I need to call him Charlie. She really likes him. And from the very beginning, to the point that she's making eyes at him while she's on a date with another guy. But she doesn't ever do anything or say anything about it. And when her sister kind of elbows her way in, and there's, you know, there's the really strong argument that the sister was really there first, even though they say that Donna Reed's character was there first. Really, Helen kissed him in the street, so there's precedence. But she's consistent. She likes him the whole time. She never gets in her sister's way. She always puts her sister first, even though she's a little bit weird at the very beginning about why is Helen here. But I guess you could read that as being concerned for Helen's career. And then she marries some other dude and then presumably refuses to have children with him. I don't know. But she's consistent at least. And their father is consistent the whole time. He's a flighty floozy, crazy.
Love.
He's fun. He's so much fun in this movie.
He's brilliant. Played by...
Best character.
Yeah. James Ellsworth, played by Walter Pigeon.
Wonderful. They
could
wonderful
not have gotten
character.
A better actor for this no. role.
And the character's so fun.
Daddy means he has a hot tip, right?
Another hot tip?
Look, we have less than 2 hours to become wealthy.
I think I can come along. I'll make a phone call.
Excellent. Now, if we pool our resources, what is your capital, my boy?
About
$40. Let's see. That means if we pool our resources, we have $40.
What a pity.
Maybe I can borrow some.
Don't you do it, Charles. He'll keep you as broke as he is.
Opportunity, my dear, is concerned with the future, not the past. Look, if it's collateral you're worrying about, I happen to own oil leases in Texas that are worth, you know, Texas.
Oh, Daddy. The oil leases are a family joke. plenty of leases, but not one drop of oil.
Charlie.
What?
I feel lucky today.
I'll see what I can dig up.
I have the utmost confidence in the courage and ingenuity of the United States Army. To horse, my boy, to horse. Destiny hates a laggard.
But you have like these, even, I almost feel like Ava Gabor's character, who is this, I love her character. She is the quintessential European woman who just goes through husbands. She's wealthy. she gets one, she gets rid of him. She gets another, she gets rid of him. But she even feels like she's got a stronger character to me than Charlie has.
Leon?
Say, Mrs. Squam?
Please. You can skip the usual. Paris is beautiful. American women love French men. French men love American women. Prices are too high. I haven't picked out my next husband yet. Might be the bartender. At least he has talent.
You've been interviewed before.
The last time, an hour ago. Wasn't very young or very attractive. The interview was very, very short. You can take your time.
A first trip to Paris?
No. First divorce here, that's all.
Why'd you choose Paris?
I get saddle sores in Reno, and I lose too much money in Las Vegas.
According to our files, you were married 4 times.
3. Annulments don't count. Leon?
Is something wrong?
Is something right? You really can't tell one of my marriages from another without a program. Husband number one. For love. Failure. Husband number two, for money. Failure, except for the money in the name Quarrel. Husband number three, an almond. He forgot to tell me he already had a wife. Husband number four, a bullfighter. 4 times a bet. Haven't had a hit.
Any children involved?
No. And that's my only contribution to humanity. I told you I was a failure. Shouldn't you be writing this down?
Oh, the interview stopped long ago.
Thank you. I'm hungry. What about dinner?
I am not on an expense account. I'm just a struggling newspaper man.
Well, stop struggling. The dinner is on my 4 husbands. I change and I'll be right down.
But what about the...
Please, Mr. Will. At home, my analyst charges $50 an hour to listen to me talk.
Even though she's obviously macking on the married men, which is skeezy, but you know who she is from the time that she's introduced until the end, even at the point when she's looking at him, disgusted by him, with how he has behaved toward her and toward his wife. She still is very consistent. And it feels like I feel like there's not a lot of reason behind why Charlie and Helen act the way they do. Helen absolutely falls victim to insta-love. This is a romance novel term, by the way. Insta-love is somebody falling in love with somebody else at first sight for absolutely no good reason. And then Charlie, it makes sense. I mean, you know, she's a beautiful woman. She kisses him. I get that. And she's crazy in love with him. It's kind of hard not to be in love with somebody that's in love with you. Thank you very much, the Von Trapps and Maria. but it's Sound of Music. Anyway, it doesn't make any sense to me the way they behave as long as they behave that way. And then when they do change, it doesn't seem like there's enough of an impetus to make those hard right turns for him to totally freak out because he didn't get a book published, but then his wife just wants to spend time with him and adore him. And he is a whiny, petulant child throwing a tantrum because he didn't get the toy he wanted. It's so strange.
Yeah, it's a really rare occurrence, I think, that the supporting characters are more well-rounded than the stars.
I agree.
Or the main characters.
Main characters, yeah.
It is very interesting. But going back to the character Marion, though, yes, she's very important. She obviously likes Charles in the beginning and everything. But then she just sort of effectively just kind of disappears through so much of the film. And as important as she is...
To the end.
At the end of the film.
Yeah.
you kind of get that, wow, she's holding a grudge for what? You know, because we really didn't see that much of that.
No, and I think there is, again, maybe we can blame it on compression, but I think that there's an amount of deus ex machina going on here where they were like, well, we need to provide a reason for him to come back to Paris, so let's have it be that his little girl gets taken away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who could take her away? Well, I mean, really, at this in this day and age, it could only really be a relative. Yeah.
But even even that, in the end, is sort of resolved in a way that made my wife go, and they don't need to, like, sign something? There's no lawyers? There's not a court that needs to make this decision? It just...
Yeah.
This is just your ending?
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe Fitzgerald just sucked as a writer. I'm being facetious. Please don't burn me to death.
I did say it's loosely based.
Right. No, and exactly. I think, gosh, I keep going back to the idea that they just cut stuff out of the movie to keep it from being over 2 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
Because without that being the reason, it's a long movie. And I was a little surprised when he comes back and his daughter, frankly, played by the same actress, the same little girl, I expected her to be in her teens. And it's been like maybe a year.
Yeah, I think they said 2.
But they act like it's been forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, meh.
Yeah, you're right. When the film opens and he's wandering around Paris, you get the impression that he's just amazed at how different Paris looks since after the war. And like the last time he was here, there was, you know, rubble and where soldiers were and this and that. Mm-hmm. And no, it's just a couple of years ago. It sets kind of an expectation and then
doesn't deliver
that at all. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm running up against as well.
Only because I noticed it. The little girl that plays the daughter, she looked really familiar to me, and I racked my brain trying to figure out what it was, and it finally struck me. She was a little girl that from the very beginning of the film, Them, about the giant ants.
Wow. Okay, I had the exact same thing happen, and I had to look it up. She is the daughter of June Allison and Leslie Nielsen in The Opposite Sex.
Oh,
and it
okay.
is not a well-known movie. It's not The Opposite of Sex. That's a different movie. This is a remake of the original movie, The Women, and remade it with June Allison. And, oh, gosh, some incredible, incredible actors. So good. Highly, highly recommend it. Leslie Nielsen in a serious role. Young Leslie Nielsen with dark hair in a serious role. Worth watching. But, yeah, same little girl. So it's really funny that you had the exact same response and found her in something else, because I had to look it up to see what she was in. I knew her face the second I saw her. It's so funny.
Yeah, I thought that was really... And after that, I just... The whole time, every time she came on the screen, I just wanted to start yelling, "Damn!"
Oh, man. Yeah. That's awesome.
Like I said, and you mentioned it as well, it is almost a 2-hour film. And while I'm not going to say it's a complete slog, you do feel those 2 hours. This is not one of those, oh, it's a 2-hour film, but man, it just felt like it was done in no time. No,
yeah.
You really felt the length of the film that you were watching with this one.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's a bad film for that. I think it's very watchable, and I don't want to just suddenly rush to the end or anything like that, but yeah, I feel like it either needed to be much longer or it needed to be quite a bit shorter.
Yeah. I think what summed it up for me was at some point I looked at, my husband was watching it with me, and I looked at him and I said, yeah, I know I'm supposed to feel bad for these characters right now, and I don't. And he said, yeah, I don't feel like I identify with either of these characters at all.
No, you're watching them to see how the story plays out.
Yeah.
You're not invested in any way.
No, you're not rooting for them at all. The whole time I kept thinking, I want the dad to get rich. Yeah, and which is a tragedy because I think what it comes down to for me is I think there was a miss in the chemistry. And where that jumped out for me was really early in the movie. You know, you have this moment where he gets kissed by this random woman on the street, and then he's like looking back to see where she is. Donna Reed shows up, and I thought, she's going to be the love interest. And because she has this gravity to her that kind of matches him. And then they run into Elizabeth Taylor again, and he's obviously enamored with her, and they run off and get champagne from the bedroom and come back. And then they go off together, and you see them sitting on a park bench together, and she's like asleep against his arm, kind of. Mm-hmm. And it felt to me like high schoolers dating. Mm. It felt like, these are people that think they're in love, but then they're going to split up, and then 5 years later, they're going to find each other again. They will have matured into full-grown humans, and they will find what they have in common and fall in love. I didn't buy it from that moment. It didn't feel like he wasn't, I think, I don't know if it was directing or if it was really just a basic chemistry issue, but I don't remember him looking at her like she's a miracle. And I don't remember her looking at him like he's a miracle. And I feel like that went the whole movie where you didn't ever have this really strong connection between the two of them and a really firm belief that these people were made to be together forever.
I'm glad you said that, because that's actually been something that's been bothering me since I watched the film, is the dialogue says that they are obsessed with each other.
Yes.
That they adore each other.
Right.
But looking and watching them, you're constantly waiting for one to realize that they don't, that it's just puppy love.
Yes.
But the dialogue says that they are made for each other.
Yeah.
And it is a little off-putting. You can't quite put your hand on whatever it is that these two people are.
Yeah. It would have rang more true for me if one of them had looked at the other and said, I don't love you that much, but I'd rather you be miserable with me than ever let you go. That would have struck for me. Like, and of course, I'm not saying I hope that relationships go that way. That would be horrible. But I would have bought that from these two. It felt like they wanted the other person in their life. But, and I think Elizabeth Taylor's character was more of the, I'll follow you anywhere. But it's a little bit of the product of the era. But for him, it felt more like, now that I got the girl, now I want my writing career to take off the ground. And when that doesn't happen, I'm going to throw a tantrum and start ignoring her. It never felt like he was writing the book for her or writing the book to support their life together. Not really. Even though, like you said, the dialogue said he said that's why. But there are 100,000 other things he could have done to support his family other than writing a book. And frankly, writing a book is the worst way to try to support your family, just so you guys know.
What's the matter, darling? Have you had dinner? Do you want me to fix something?
Go away, Helen. Let me alone.
Is it something I've done? Please, Charlie, whatever it is.
All right. You're a good wife. You're devoted and loyal. You've done your duty. Now, please go back to your party and let me alone.
I'm only trying to help.
Help what?
You, me, us. I don't know.
Help what, this? Can you help another rejection? Can anybody help that?
Why? Because some publisher turned you down again.
Yes, again.
Again, Helen. Again. Can you help her that I'm stupid enough to spend 5 years writing 3 stupid books? Can you help her that I'm no writer?
But you are. You're wonderful. They're the ones that are stupid, not you.
Dear Mr. Wills, we regret to inform you. I'm no good, Helen. Go away and let me alone.
Oh, Charlie.
Please, I can't explain my failure to you. So be a good girl and let me alone.
But you're not a failure, not to me.
When I was 20, I used to think I would write great books. I would be able to do this because I was different. I wanted perfection, and that made me different. But I'm not 20 anymore, and it's too late now.
We'll try again.
No! I just don't have what it takes. All I need to do now is get used to the idea. I'm rich. For the price of a few drinks, I could buy fame and friends or something like them. Why spend years writing? I can hold court in some noisy bar and criticize writing and talk about writing and...
He's in flippin' Paris, you know, the fashion capital of the world. Mm-hmm. He could go write ad copy and support his family.
And make probably pretty good money at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that chemistry's not there for me. Which is interesting because I can't think of another role that Van Johnson played where I bought him as a strong love interest. Now, I don't know a whole lot of his roles. Elizabeth Taylor, I feel like I've seen her in a few things where I buy her being the kind of swept up, passionate romance. But I can't think of anything. I guess maybe I haven't seen enough Van Johnson to have seen that. But I also have to question whether that actually is the right role for him. I think he works really well as a kind of Audie Murphy stand-in, as a kind of, you know, the brave soldier. Like you said, put him in an action film. He makes a lot of sense. He makes a lot of sense as a James Bond kind of character who sweeps the girl off her feet and then sweeps out and rides off into the sunset. But I don't know that I buy him as a passionate lover. That's an interesting question. Now I'm really interested to know. Now I feel like I need to watch a whole bunch of movies with Van Johnson to see if he's any better as a leading man than he is in this movie. But I have to question it. I'm not convinced that he would be. He does really good at the starry-eyed looking off into the distance, but he doesn't have the David Niven passion eyes. I had to bring him back in. Man, I'll tell you what.
How many, you know, it's actually probably been maybe 3 episodes.
I haven't talked about David Niven. Oh, sorry. But there are a few guys out there, like contemporaries of Van Johnson, that when they look at a woman, they look at a woman. They got the Mr. Darcy eyes, right? But I don't see it with him. I don't remember seeing it at any point in this movie. So now I have to ask, is it a chemistry thing or is it that he's not good in this kind of role?
Yeah, maybe. And with Elizabeth Taylor, the way she looks and even the way that she portrays herself in this film, I just feel like she would be better off as, and she's probably, I'm sure she's played roles like this before. I feel like she needs to be that one that if you're going to love her, you're going to be willing to be burned.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That I don't love you, but I'm not willing to let you go kind of character. Great. It's funny. I ran across I know I mentioned this in an earlier episode, but I ran across a 90s version of an Agatha Christie book that starred her and... Oh, gosh, who was it? I have to think of who this was because it's so worth watching. It's The Mirror Cracked from 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her playing opposite Tony Curtis with Rock Hudson in it. Ah, so great. Angela Lansbury, of course, and Kim Novak. And that is a 1980s made-for-TV Agatha Christie movie, and Elizabeth Taylor is stellar in it. She, and I mentioned in her older roles, I thought she was better. In this movie, I think she's like a washed-up older actress, and she is phenomenal. And I think maybe a little bit of At this time, in the movie that we're watching now, in the last time I saw Paris, I mentioned she's, like, ethereal. And she has that kind of distant stare, and she's really good at it. And I think that Van Johnson's pretty good at that distant stare. But when you bring it in close, it's like they're looking past the person.
I was going to say, they're both looking at the wall behind the other.
Yes. It does. You don't feel that connection. But I think what you're saying is exactly right. Elizabeth Taylor is one of those characters, or is one of those actors that you feel like you want the person to be willing to walk through hell to be with them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense to say, I love you, but my writing career is more important. It's Elizabeth Taylor. How does that make any sense?
Yes, absolutely. She should either be the character that, as I said, that if you're willing to love, you got to be willing to be burned, or she's got to be that character where you will do anything and everything you can to keep her on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And just to have her as the devoted wife,
it's too simple. There's another, we're both skirting the same issue. There's another issue with her character that's problematic from the very beginning. And it's a trope, and it will absolutely ruin the end of the movie for anybody that hasn't watched it yet. And so I'm hesitant to say it, but you'll know exactly what I'm talking about based on what I'm not saying. And it doesn't work for me for this character at all. It just doesn't. And again, I imagine that it's in the book, but it doesn't make any sense to me in the movie. It's what you're saying, that she's too, I hate to use the word powerful. I'm not sure that's the right word, but she's too present. She's too much of a presence to be treated the way she is in this story, to fulfill the role of this character in the story. There are other actresses that are contemporaries of hers that I would buy in this role and that I would believe in this role, the self-sacrificing wife. But I can't believe her in this role. I don't. She's too removed to really work there.
Do you think she would, as an actress, do you think she would have been better in a role like the Ava Gabor character?
No.
Could she have done that? No?
It's a good question. No, because she, honestly, I think that her character is perfect at the beginning of the movie. I think that I just want to have fun and drift through life makes perfect sense. Where that's problematic is where it then becomes, no, but what I really care about is my husband spending all this time with me. That's not that attitude. It's an inconsistent character trait. Instead of being what she is in the beginning, where she's wants everything to be fun and along, you know, just everything be fun, then all of a sudden that's not what it's about for her anymore. And it starts to ring false. So no, I don't think that she would have, I don't think that she's, it's almost like she's not self-aware enough. At this age, in this role, that mm-hmm. character is not self-aware enough to be the Ava Gabor character. Because Ava Gabor knows what she's about. She knows she's hitting on married men.
As soon as I asked the question, my own brain started working on it. I thought, you know, the thing is, the Ava Gabor character is actually, like you just said, she knows who she is. She makes no apologies for who she is, but she's very polite and friendly and nice.
Yeah. I would have bought Elizabeth Taylor as Marion. I absolutely would have. The woman that falls madly in love with a man, but he marries somebody else. And so she becomes bitter about it. I almost didn't buy Donna Reed in that role.
No, I think I struggled with
that. Yeah. So I almost feel like they miscast them, mm-hmm. that it would be hard. And Donna Reed is a gorgeous woman. It's not that she's not an incredibly beautiful woman. She is. But Elizabeth Taylor does have that sparkle to her, right? And so it would be hard to imagine somebody walking into the room and between the two of them picking Donna Reed through no fault of her own. It's that exotic mystery, right? But at the same time, I would absolutely buy her as the self-sacrificing wife 100% of the time. I would buy her as the woman that would stick by the man no matter what happens, and then becoming disillusioned, trying to make him jealous, spending time with Roger Moore. I would buy that. But I don't buy it from Elizabeth Taylor. And because I don't feel like at any point she's trying to use Roger Moore's character to make her husband jealous. It's like she's just hanging out with him because he's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the point that she finally decides that she is going to use him to make, well, not to make him jealous, she's actually going to run away with him, then it's like, well, wait, when did you suddenly become that disillusioned? At no point do I feel like that's justified by her as this character. So, but I would have bought it from Donna Reed. I don't buy it from Elizabeth Taylor. I would buy Elizabeth Taylor being self-sacrificing to her sister, but loving the man her sister is married to the point of becoming venomous. I would totally buy that. 100%.
Well, definitely could see Elizabeth Taylor doing the dagger eyes. Oh, that would have been...
Yes.
You would have felt that.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, I think what we're describing is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I do.
Yeah.
I think that's the closest approximation. And of course, it's a different casting. Oh, and gosh. I mean, I would not have thought I would be a Cat on a Hot Tin Roof kind of person, but I am. I also am thinking of The Long Hot Summer. I think I might be conflating those two movies. I am definitely conflating them. But I think that the premise still stands. I think that what we're saying is still accurate. I think there's some miscasting going on here. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Van Johnson, I like him as an actor. I like seeing him in these movies. But whether it's him or him with Elizabeth Taylor or the type of character that they're being cast as, it doesn't quite work.
And maybe that's it. Maybe that is a case of, oh, we'll put Elizabeth Taylor in this film. That's going to put, you know, people in the seats. Maybe, maybe Van Johnson would have done absolutely fine in this film against a different actress.
Yeah.
It's a very good possibility.
Yeah, I think that's the case. So we're a little bit talking in circles at this point, which is the goal. We want to get it to a point where we're like, okay, no, now we figured out what the problem is. There's some stuff about this movie that I wanted to like it, but I just plain can't.
Again, going back to what I started to say earlier, you know, I think it's a fine watch. I can watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't love it. I think I went into this film maybe thinking I would come out really loving this film because of all the people in it, because of the beautiful people in it, because of the romance and how they, you know, they look at each other and starry-eyed and they're like, oh my gosh, you find someone that looks at you the way Elizabeth Taylor looks at Van Johnson, you know, that sort of
right.
thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I this is not a romance for the ages for me or anything. It just
mm-mm.
It's an okay film.
Yeah.
And it should be with this cast in Paris. It should be more than okay.
It should be. But let's take just a second and talk a little bit about F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Okay. You probably know more than I do.
The movie everybody knows him for. Everybody knows him for the same movie, right? Even if you don't know you know him for the same movie, you all know him for the same movie. The title of which is completely escaping my mind right now. Dang it, I gotta look it up. Oh, shoot, Leonardo DiCaprio did the remake. Okay, and before we go any further, I want to make sure I'm not a crazy person and that was actually written by F. Scott Fitzgerald, because I think it was.
It's his third novel.
Okay. So, the movie everybody knows him for is The Great Gatsby. And I know there was a big deal about it. Like, everybody, yeah, I love Baz Luhrmann. Oh my gosh, I love Baz Luhrmann. I think he's an absolute genius. Carey Mulligan, exceptional actor. Leonardo DiCaprio, exceptional actor. The Great Gatsby is without a doubt one of my least favorite stories ever. It is depressing. It sucks. I am being a little bit emphatic, but I hate it. I don't understand why people get so excited about it. I understand it's one of the best books ever written. It's an incredible American piece of literature. I understand that. I hate it. So with that knowledge, knowing that The Last Time I Saw Paris is based on an F. Scott Fitzgerald book, I'm not terribly shocked that I don't really like it. Because it's just a little bit of that thing where there's just too much drama and too much ego involved and too much self-deprecation and, you know, negative narcissism, that kind of thing. I'm not surprised that I don't like the story, and I wouldn't be surprised if I read the book and didn't like the book. This is not a romance. The last time I saw Paris is not a romance. No, the way you know that is because it does not have a happily ever after. One of the requirements for a romance is that the characters end with a happy ever after. And it does not exist for these people. And it doesn't feel like it should exist for these people. And that's the bigger sin. Because if you can have a romantic tragedy and feel like these people, as much as I hate Romeo and Juliet, no question in my mind that they belong together. You know, no question in my mind. They sure belong together. They're idiot teenagers, but they belong together. There are so many stories out there where the two main characters, you look at them and go, these people 100% belong together. And this is not that movie. And I think that's probably the reason I dislike it the most, is because at no point do I root for the main characters. And honestly, F. Scott Fitzgerald, as far as I know, didn't write romances. And so maybe part of the problem with this movie is that you and I both went into it expecting it to be a romance, and it is not. So no, all that to
just,
say,
it is just a drama.
Yeah. So it's our fault. Yep. In a sense it is, but in a sense it's also just, we didn't pick it because it was a drama or anything like that. There's an element of dissatisfaction to this movie for me that I'm not going to be able to overcome. I thought when we started talking and you were super excited, I thought, oh, I'm definitely going to increase my Othel rating once we're done talking about this. And actually, I think the opposite's true. I think I'm more disappointed with it now, which is kind of hard because while we were watching it, like you said, it felt a little bit like a slog. I definitely didn't care very much about the main characters. I want everybody to have a happy ending, but I wasn't rooting for them. I wasn't pulling for them. I wasn't sad at the idea that they might not have a happy ending, you know. And I mean, he comes back to Paris by himself, so you get some idea at the very beginning of the movie. You know, it's the classic Moulin Rouge, the woman I love is dead. You know, you don't know what happens to the characters at the end, but he's there by himself, so something is going on. And I didn't feel sad about any of that. And so, you know, I guess we're coming to the rating. Shall I just jump into it?
Please do. Go ahead.
Which is funny because, I was waffling and I would like to give this movie a high rating. We've talked about how phenomenal the cast is. It's good quality. The director obviously has some massive chops. And this story kills it for me. So if you're an Elizabeth Taylor completionist, watch this movie. 100% watch this movie. But for me, every actor in this movie has a better movie out there. Every actor. Even the little girl has a better movie
out there. Yeah, I'm going to watch them before I go to bed tonight.
Yes. And let's even mention her performance in this movie is not exceptional. She's a little girl. She's supposed to be a little girl, and I didn't buy her as a little girl. How hard is that to mess up? It was not great. So I thought I would end up giving this, I thought I would give it 3. And then when you start talking, I thought, no, I'm going to end up bumping it up to 4. And the end result is I'm giving it 2. There are too many really high quality ingredients in this movie for it to be as unsatisfying of a movie as it is. So I won't say this is the worst movie ever. Don't ever watch it. I think there's some reasons to watch it. If you're a completionist for any of the actors, for the director, for the author of the book, if you want to see how they screwed up F. Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece of a book and took it and just destroyed it and made it into The Last Time I Saw Paris, absolutely watch this movie. I think it's worth it. I even to watch this movie just to decide if Christopher and I are totally wrong about it. But for me, it's a 2. I can't do better than that.
I think I'm going to go in right there with you. I was thinking the same thing, that I'd be willing to give this one right in the middle and say it's a 3. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I think there's so much talent that isn't utilized. Mm-hmm. And that makes it extremely frustrating. you know, the script says one thing, the actions say another.
Yeah.
The script asks you to believe, you know, a lot of big things without giving you anything to support those things. And it just, it's a little frustrating. So, yeah, I'm right there with you with the two. I just, like you said, everyone's got a better film. Roger Moore looks like a child in this film himself.
He's so good looking. He's just so darn good looking. But, I mean, between him and Rock Hudson, man, what do you choose? Wow. But, yeah, he's so young in it. It's hilarious.
But, yeah, he goes on to do so much better things. You want to see him around this age in something a lot more fun and a lot more enjoyable? Go watch some of his The Saint television series.
Oh, yes. I didn't even think about that, but that's a great suggestion.
Yeah, that's right around this era. I think, let's see, this is 54. The Saint was probably mid to late 50s, so it might have been a little bit after this. Oh, yeah. Those are a lot of fun. Go check those out.
So let's put a dream team together here. If you're going to watch a movie for each of these people, obviously for the director, it's going to be Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah.
For Elizabeth Taylor. Oh, go ahead.
National. I was going to say, would you give that for Elizabeth Taylor, or would you jump back to National Velvet?
No, for, you know what, for her, I think she is not exceptional in National Velvet. She's very cute, dreamy, sweet, adorable little girl. But for me, it would be The Mirror Cracked. It'd be that 1980 okay. made for TV. I think her, that role is tailor made for her.
Oh, I'm going to look that so film up. Good. That cast that you read off alone right there is enough. So oh, I'm going to look for that myself.
Yeah, I recommend it. I can't even tell you where I found it. It probably was on some random streaming service. I'm interested to know, for Van Johnson, clearly Go for Broke.
Yes.
I mean, such a great movie, and not just tooting our horn, but really if for the history in it, for the cast in it, for the information, just, it's such, so good. What would you say for Walter Pigeon?
Oh, I'd go for maybe, I'm biased, but I would go for Forbidden Planet.
Oh, and another Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
So good. for, gosh, let's see, for Donna Reed, It's a Wonderful Life, what else can you say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Not that a fan of the film myself.
No? Okay. No. Fair enough. I think I'd have to dig a little bit to find something that I liked more than that. The Donna Reed Show is kind of the thing, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of what we all know her for. Eva Gabor, I mean, oh gosh.
The Rescuers Down Under.
That's what I was going to say. It's so wrong that that's what we think of, but that and Green Acres, the Aristocats, I could just dig through. She's just, but I think, honestly, I loved her in this movie. She was wonderful in this movie, and Walter Pigeon were wonderful in this movie. I wanted the two of them to get together.
That would have been a great ending.
That would have been so good.
Oh, if he would have been the next husband on her list, that would have been fantastic.
Yeah. So there's so many things. For me, the girl that played the little girl, Sandy Desher, I would say watch The Opposite Sex. I really enjoyed it, but I watched it when I was super young, and I thought it was exciting and interesting. Of course, Leslie Nielsen, young, yummy. It has to be them for her. I mean, come on.
Yep.
So there are so many recommendations we can make for better movies with this cast. It's just too bad. It's just too bad that there was such an all-star lineup and then the end result is so dissatisfying.
Yeah.
But it's fun to get to talk about it. So for that sake, I'm really glad it's out of copyright.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we've said all that we can say about The Last Time I Saw Paris, except that maybe the title doesn't fit terribly well either.
The other thing to say is by about 3/4 of the way through this movie, I was sick of that song. I literally said to my husband, if I never hear the song again, it'll be too soon. I saw Paris. So, oh, yuck.
Her heart was warm and gay. I heard the laughter of her heart in every street cafe. The last time
Well, that's it. The song was actually predated the film.
Yeah.
It was actually already a bit of a hit. And so, yes, they used it as many times as they possibly could in this film.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I'm sure, why they named it what they did. Mm-hmm. Hey, it's set in Paris. Let's call it The Last Time I Saw Paris, and then we'll just use the heck out of it. But, yeah. Boo.
Yeah.
Boo.
Well, then I guess that'll do it for this episode. Always thanks, everybody, for listening. And Lydia, thank you for discussing the film. And it's always a pleasure, regardless.
Yeah, for me as well. I wish there were anything else we could watch Elizabeth Taylor in. I don't think we're going to find anything else. We stumbled across this one on accident, and I'm glad we did. But I'm looking forward to seeing something that is a little more satisfying, hopefully, next month.
And we will be back in a month with another film. But if you have watched The Last Time I Saw Paris and you have any comments, please send them our way at orphanedentertainment@gmail.com or come to the Facebook group or come join us anywhere in the social medias. Follow the link in the show notes. I guess we will talk to everybody in 30 days. So thank you very much for listening. And Lydia, thanks again. Bye, everybody.
Thank you all. Bye.
And when we return, we will parlez-vous en français as we talk about The Last Time I Saw Paris. That sounds so terrible, but I couldn't think of anything else.